Thank you, Fari, for the opportunity to speak to you today. It is a great pleasure to be speaking at this conference again, although it's a shame it can't be in person. So much has changed since I spoke at the conference 12 months ago. Last year, I highlighted three particular challenges facing the banking sector: the increase in the availability and use of big data, and the competition from fintechs and big techs, tighter regulation, which could lead to disintermediation, and then also the change in community expectations on banks' behaviour. Not on my list at the time was the biggest challenge that banks are now facing, a pandemic. We didn't know it at the time, but the latest evidence suggests that the virus that causes COVID-19 was already circulating 12 months ago. The pandemic has resulted in the second major global recession in a bit over a decade. During the GFC, what was initially a relatively small shock that originated from within the financial system was amplified by weaknesses in the financial system, causing significant economic loss. In contrast, this time there's been a very large shock that was actually external to the financial system. An external shock would have exposed any weaknesses within the financial system. But banks have performed well so far through the pandemic. In fact, they've been cushioning the shock by continuing to lend and supporting households and businesses. In fact, in at least 55 jurisdictions around the world, banks have been able to defer loan repayments for borrowers who've been affected by the pandemic. How the banking system has been affected by the early stages of the crisis and how it's responded has been very different this time round. Spreads on bank bonds are one way to demonstrate this greater resilience. While bank bond spreads peaked at almost double the spread on corporate bonds during the GFC, this time around, the peak in bank bond spreads was only a little bit higher than for corporate bonds. The resilience is the result of the wholesale reform of bank regulations that followed the GFC and the unprecedented policy actions taken this year by central banks and fiscal authorities. As I noted last year, the post-GFC reforms required banks to hold more capital and more liquid assets, as well as generally to reduce the complexity and riskiness of their operations. More capital enables banks to withstand larger credit losses. More highly quality liquid assets enable banks to withstand larger liquidity shocks. Less complex and less risky operations, including improved lending standards, mean that banks' assets performance deteriorates less in response to shocks. At the start of this year, internationally, banks' Tier 1 capital ratios were around double what they were back in 2007. Relative to their assets, international banks' holdings of cash assets had increased by about 40%. These reforms were implemented to prevent banks exacerbating an economic downturn or financial disruption, including by contracting their lending. So far, these reforms have significantly helped. But the resilience of the banking system up to now doesn't mean that the risks have passed. We've had the largest contraction in global output since the Great Depression, and that impairs some households and businesses' ability to repay their loans. The liquidity phase of the crisis is giving way to a solvency phase. So what does that mean for the future of banking in the COVID era? In the remainder of my speech today, I want to focus on two new big challenges for the Australian banks. First of all, the resilience in this large economic downturn. And secondly, the impact of low interest rates on their profits. Australian banks have strong capital, strong balance sheets, much stronger than before the GFC. The average Tier 1 capital ratio for Australian banks has increased from around 7.5% in 2007 before the GFC to almost 14% today. The quality of capital has also increased, and all Australian banks have CET1 ratios that exceed their unquestionably strong benchmark set by APRA. Liquid asset holdings have also increased. the ratio of liquid assets to total assets has increased by almost a quarter since 2007. Australian banks are also highly profitable. In 2019, the combined profits of the banking system were in the vicinity of $30 billion, and their return on equity at 11% exceeded their cost of equity. Indeed, most of the major banks' big increase in capital in recent years has been internally generated, highlighting their profitability. This balance sheet strength, along with the low level of interest rates and regulatory accommodation, has enabled Australian banks to provide loan repayment deferrals to households and small and medium businesses. At the peak, some 11% of housing loans and 17% of SME loans by value had deferred repayments. With the economic contraction turning out to be less severe than initially feared, and the recovery well and truly underway, many borrowers have resumed repayments. Now, only a little over 4% of both housing and SME loans have repayment deferrals. By hibernating the repayments of borrowers facing temporary liquidity strains, loan repayment deferrals avoided unnecessary household and business defaults, the impairment to their balance sheet, and adverse long-run effects. Loan deferrals have also avoided the asset fire sales that can result from borrowers who are in or near default. But it is important that loan repayment deferrals are temporary and not used to hide problem loans. APRA has published detailed information on loan repayment deferrals by institution so that investors can accurately assess banks' financial health. APRA has also set an end date for the current regulatory treatment of loans with deferred repayments. After the 31st of March next year, banks will have to revert to holding substantially more capital against loans that are deferred or fall on repayments. In the ballpark, this will be about five times more capital. Another way to assess the health of banks is through stress tests. Stress testing gained prominence in the GFC and has been an important tool for central banks and prudential regulators to understand the resilience of banks in the current COVID shock. One specific use of stress testing has been to project banks' capital position under various scenarios. This informs regulators' policies and banks' own decisions regarding capital distribution. The Reserve Bank of Australia has a top-down stress testing model which uses balance sheet data for nine banks and some extra data such as our own data set on securitised mortgages. A substantial advantage of top-down stress testing models is they can be used quickly and efficiently to consider a range of scenarios, and that has been especially useful this year given the rapidly changing conditions. The stress testing model uses calibrated and assumed relationships between macroeconomic variables and various components of banks' balance sheets to assess how banks might fare in various economic scenarios. For example, the model can simulate how different loan portfolios perform for a given fall in GDP and property prices and increase in the unemployment rate. The resulting credit losses have result in lower profits and so affect the projection of banks' capital. Another important element of the model is projecting how risk weights change with economic conditions. But we can't forget that all models are simplifications. By definition, they can't capture all the nuances, and so they will be wrong by some margin. A particularly big challenge in the current environment is that we're extrapolating to very extreme events to which we don't have data from comparable historical precedents in Australia. So there's a lot of uncertainty. Our own model is continuously undergoing development, especially this year when they've been so important. Using the projections from the Statement of Monetary Policy for GDP and unemployment, and adding assumptions about property prices, we can project banks' capital ratios in a couple of scenarios. In the baseline scenario, we take GDP, which is around 4% below its peak by December 2020, and the unemployment rate is close to 8%, with housing prices around 2% below their peak. This results in the major bank CET1 ratios falling by around 60 basis points. To put this into perspective, the major banks all have management capital buffers of at least 300 basis points, and that's over and above their 350 basis point regulatory buffer. Notably in this scenario, over 90% of the decline in the CET1 ratio comes from increased risk weights. Only a small part comes from credit losses. In the downside scenario, GDP is 5% below its peak by the year end and recovers more slowly. The unemployment rate peaks later at close to 9%. And there is a 20% assumed peak to trough fall in housing prices. Even with these more adverse economic outcomes, the major banks' CET1 ratios are projected to decline by just 100 basis points. While credit losses are larger in this scenario, the increase in credit risk weights still accounts for over two-thirds of the decline in bank CET1 ratios. These results are consistent with stress testing results that have been released this morning by APRA in their paper, but they're not identical because our scenarios differ and because there are differences in model specification, reflecting the assumptions that I talked about before. While there is necessarily uncertainty around any stress testing result, they point to Australian banks being very resilient. But intuitively, why is that? Even if the probability of default increased substantially, 60% of banks' loans are mortgages. And on those mortgages, the current loan-to-value valuation ratios are not high. And that reflects the fact that these loans initially had fairly moderate LVRs. They've accumulated significant scheduled and excess loan repayments. And there's been property price growth. So loss given default is not extreme, even with large house price falls. Commercial real estate exposures, which often cause large losses, are relatively small for Australian banks at just 6% of assets, down from 11% during the GFC. In addition, the LVRs for commercial real estate are typically just over 50%, and loans for property development require a substantial share of pre-sales. And that brings me to the second issue I want to discuss: the impact of act of an extended period of very low interest rates on banks' profits, and so their ability to generate capital. In essentially all advanced economies, short-term interest rates and even long-term sovereign yields are close to zero or even negative. In Australia, the Reserve Bank has set targets for the cash rate and three-year Australian government bond yield of just 10 basis points. And even 10-year Australian government bond yields are yielding just under 1%. Interest rates are likely to remain low for some time. As the governor has said, the Reserve Bank Board is not expecting to increase the cash rate for at least 3 years. Internationally, there's been a lot of focus on the impact of very low interest rates on banks' profits, given some economies have had very low rates since the GFC. In thinking about the impact of very low interest rates on banks' profits, it's important to consider why interest rates are low. Central banks cut policy rates to exceptionally low levels in the GFC and during the current pandemic because of the large negative shocks to output that resulted in significant spare capacity. If interest rates were not cut to exceptionally low levels, then output would have been even weaker, loan portfolios would have been even more stressed, and banks would have incurred even larger credit losses. So the first thing to note about low interest rates is that they indirectly contribute to higher bank profits by stimulating economic activity. But low interest rates contribute to lower banks' profits in other more direct ways. Almost all of banks' assets earn interest, but some liabilities, in particular equity and some transaction deposits, pay little or no interest. So if the return on banks' assets moves with the cash rate, lower interest rates will tend to reduce the total interest earned by more than the total interest paid. Banks also adjust their pricing and their composition of their balance sheet in response to structural changes such as low interest rates. In particular, internationally, some banks have increased their fee income, reduced their operating costs, or where they can, have repriced the margins on loans and deposits. Regulatory changes after the GFC that are unrelated to low rates have also resulted in banks holding more low-yielding, high-quality liquid assets and generally de-risking their balance sheet. And these factors have contributed to lower bank profits. So ultimately, the net effect of low interest rates on banks' profits is an empirical question. Studies have focused on the direct effects. Globally, they tend to find that a reduction in interest rates results in lower profits because they reduce net interest income. A 100 basis point fall in short-term interest rates is generally found to reduce the return on assets by between 5 or 10 basis points after about 1 year. There is some evidence that this effect is larger when interest rates are lower. To emphasize my earlier point, this is the direct effect, controlling for GDP, and does not include any positive effects that operate indirectly through the impact that lower rates will have on GDP. The impact of banks' profits can also depend on the length of time that interest rates remain low. Some banks, particularly in Australia, have interest rate hedges which smooth profits and so delay the reduction in profit from falls in interest rates. Separately, if long-term interest rates are also low, say because short-term rates are expected to be low for an extended period or the term premium is low, the impact on banks' profits is typically found to be larger. Banks generally fund long-term loans with short-term liabilities, and so a flat yield curve depresses the return on their assets relative to their liabilities. This second effect is less of an issue in Australia because around 3/4 of Australian banks' assets are variable rate loans, and they are funded with variable rate deposits. This suggests that changes in interest rates might have less of an effect on Australian banks' profits. Interest rates in Australia did not reach the very low levels that they got to in other economies during the GFC, and they've been higher than in most advanced economies since then. So very low interest rates haven't been a constraint for Australian banks' profits to the extent that they have been in other countries. But with risk-free interest rates out to 3 years at around 10 basis points, and the cash rate not expected to rise for another 3 years, very low rates will increasingly influence Australian banks' profits. But should we expect a similar impact to what we've seen internationally? One factor that might reduce the impact of very low interest rates on Australian banks' profits is the composition of their liabilities. The major Australian banks source around 1/3 of their funding from wholesale markets, and that's a larger share than for many international banks. The cost of wholesale funding is not constrained by a zero lower bound, in contrast to what has been observed for deposit interest rates internationally. While the small Australian banks have a much larger share of deposit funding than the large banks, some 80% versus 60%, much of this is higher cost deposits on which the interest rate has declined as the policy interest rate has been reduced. In addition, total funding costs are being pushed down by the Reserve Bank's Term Funding Facility. The TFF provides banks with 3-year funding equal to at least 5% of their credit outstanding, with new drawings costing the cash rate. This is less than the cost of a 3-year bank bond, even after the fall in bank bond yields, which has followed from reduced issuance, given the ample deposit funding they have and the TFF funding. Another factor that could reduce the impact of very low interest rates on Australian banks' profits is that they have very little interest rate risk. APRA, unlike other regulators, requires banks to include interest rate risk on the banking book in the calculation of risk weights. This provides a strong incentive to match the repricing tenor of assets and liabilities, or to hedge the interest rate risk. The major banks are required to hold capital to cover 97.5% of losses from movements in interest rates. As an example, imagine a 300 basis point increase in interest rates across the yield curve. The potential loss on a 5-year fixed rate $100 asset would be around $10 to $15 if there was no offsetting interest rate positions elsewhere in the bank's book. They would be required to hold $10 to $15 in capital against this potential loss. Overall, very low interest rates may well reduce the Australian bank's profits, but possibly by less than for banks in other jurisdictions. Australian banks haven't faced very low interest rates for an extended period of time, but the estimates that we can produce for Australia have found that 100 basis point downward shift in the yield curve lowers the return on assets by around 5%, 5 basis points after 1 year. These estimates are rough, but they're around the lower end of the range of estimates internationally. And that's consistent with the intuition that I described before, that the impact may be a bit smaller in Australia. So to sum up, there's no doubt that the COVID-19 pandemic will be a test of banks globally and in Australia. In Australia, the economic shock is much larger than it was in the GFC and for many decades before that. But Australian banks are better prepared than they were even prior to the GFC. Their much higher liquid asset holdings helped them earlier this year when there was a liquidity phase to the pandemic crisis. And banks are well capitalized. Importantly, they have very large buffers, and those buffers are there to be used, not preserved. And the buffers will enable them to continue lending and supporting their customers, and so the economic recovery. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jonathan. That's fantastic. And I think it's very reassuring to hear from a senior member of the Reserve Bank that our banks are safe, as well as their future is bright, despite the fact that obviously, as you acknowledge, there are short-term challenges. And I'm sure it's very reassuring to hear this, if you like, optimistic perspective from the Reserve Bank. I'm just wondering whether there could be some questions that people may have. I'm just going to look at one of them. It says, thus far, house price have not fallen by anywhere near the amount some had forecasted earlier in the year. Do you expect that house prices will adversely react to COVID-19 in a lagged fashion?
Thank you. Yeah, this is a very interesting observation, and it's an important part of the stress testing that we do. The property price assumption is very significant in there because, you know, as I said, 60% of loans are mortgages. Those loans are secured, and so what happens with property prices is an important determinant of losses. In our stress testing model, we can demonstrate that for even if you have a given fall in GDP, an increase in the unemployment rate, you really need to have large declines in property prices in order to increase the losses that banks experience. Certainly earlier this year, when we were facing the start of the pandemic and there was a lot of uncertainty about economic outcomes, there was, you know, I think quite broadly expectations of price falls. You know, I think many people were expecting price falls of some 10%. But that's not what we've seen. We've seen some price falls, particularly in Sydney and Melbourne. Price falls have been more significant for inner city areas, in particular for apartments. But overall, property prices have performed much better than and people had expected. Some of that, I guess, reflects that economic outcomes have not been as bad as was initially feared. The increase in the unemployment rate has not been as large. And so for a lot of households, their financial position has not actually deteriorated. And for them, they're seeing the benefits of exceptionally low interest rates. And so far, there has actually been reasonable demand for housing. But I think, we're not completely out of the woods yet when it comes to housing prices. You know, we do have to remember that there is a significant decline in the population growth rate in Australia because of the reduction in immigration. And the housing construction industry is building for what they think the population and demand is going to be, in some 18 months or, whatever their construction lag is. And so they've been building in anticipation of stronger population growth than is turning out to be the case. So I think there is still going to be some adjustment that's occurring in the housing market. And there will be, different outcomes for different types of housing, whether it's inner city housing or property that's, on the edges of the city, which now seems more desirable when a larger share of people are working from home. So I think there is going to be some structural change in dynamics in the housing market as well.
Okay, thank you for that. I'm just wondering also, what is your, anticipation of investment by the business community, in the immediate months and years ahead? And what's the impact of, business investment? Let's assume we're looking at a more positive scenario where COVID-19 hopefully will be better under control in 2021. Would that have any impact on the balance sheet of the banks as well as the activities, The volume of business might expand even if it's a low interest environment. And what's the implication of that on overall health of the Australian economy?
So business investment is certainly one of the more cyclical parts of economic activity. I think the very positive thing is that we've seen the banking system continue to support businesses. They're able to lend. The banks have sufficient capital that they're able to advance new loans. They're not having to constrain their lending. Businesses are able to borrow at exceptionally low interest rates. So that removes any constraint for businesses. Funding is available at cheap interest rates and in sufficient quantities that they need. So then all we need is the demand for businesses to want to invest. And I think a lot of that comes to how confident they're feeling about the outlook. So as we see the economy starting to recover, which it already is, then hopefully that will result in businesses feeling more optimistic about the future demand for their services and so be more willing to invest. And that will certainly be an important part of the recovery.
Also, a follow-up question is, as the interest rate remains low, would that, create more incentives for investors to start, getting into a housing market, either buying existing houses or building new one? And that in turn could stimulate, the housing market. At the same time, the volume of loans could increase, which in turn could also benefit, everyone, including banks' profits.
Well, that's right. So an important channel of transmission of monetary policy is that lower interest rates do tend to stimulate asset prices, all asset prices. And that's partly that there's a substitution. So if you're receiving less money, less return on either deposits or bank bonds, or there's more of an incentive to switch to other assets, and that tends to bid up those prices. So that is always an important transmission channel of monetary policy, whether we're in the current situation where interest rates are around zero and we have QE, or back when we had interest rates at 5 or 7%. Monetary policy is working in the same way and affecting asset prices at that time. One mechanism there is that when you do have assets such as housing, for which a lot of people do tend to fund that with debt by borrowing, then you know you are likely to have some increase in borrowing. Again, that's part of the transmission channel of monetary policy. And it's a positive thing that the banks in Australia are well positioned to be able to support that lending and to provide ample funding. It's important, obviously, that banks do continue to have strong lending standards. And in Australia, there has been a significant improvement in lending standards over the past 5 or so years. And that's an important consideration in this environment, to think of the work that APRA did in improving the lending standards of the banks, in recognising back in 2014, 2015, that there, you know, was a larger share of what we might think of being riskier types of lending, lending of a large share, some 40% of loans being interest only, a larger share of high LVR loan lending, not high internationally, but high relative to Australian history. And so it was an important consideration to improve the quality of that lending in Australia across those metrics. And so it's positive that both in housing lending and business lending, standards across the board on average seem to be very good. And so that's more positive that when you do have exceptionally low interest rates, which will stimulate lending, that we can be more confident that that lending will be, you know, of a good standard, high quality, and that reduces the financial stability risks that otherwise we could be concerned about.
Another question is with regard to the composition of the liabilities of our banks. Only one third for large banks, we are dependent on wholesale market. How do you see, if you like, this composition is evolving? We know that it was more than that earlier on, and they would like to hear a little bit of elaboration on the of dependence on wholesale market. Thanks.
Absolutely. So it has been a very significant change in Australia over the past decade or more. Prior to the GFC, banks were funding a very large share through wholesale markets. And following the GFC, there was a recognition of the benefits of funding a larger share from deposits. Bank regulation favoured that. Investors clearly had a preference for that. And so the Australian banks did shift a large share of their funding to deposits. And that's continued to increase. In the most recent episode, we've again seen a fairly significant shift where, partly as a result of fiscal policy, which has provided a lot of funding to households and also to businesses, that has helped to boost deposits of households and businesses and increase the flow into banks. The other important factor has been some of one part of the stimulus package of the Reserve Bank of Australia, the TFF. And so that's providing banks with up to 5% or 5% or even more, depending on their lending activities, of their credit outstanding as funding from the Reserve Bank. And that's 3-year funding that's coming at the cash rate. So that's another form of important funding that's changing the composition of the liabilities of the Australian banks. And the consequence of that is that Australian banks haven't been borrowing as much in wholesale markets. So that there's a reduced supply of Australian bank bonds, which then actually also works to reduce the cost of bank bonds, because you know there are still investors that want those assets, and so they bid up their prices. And so that, in effect, also makes the funding cheaper for Australian banks. So all of these things are contributing to sort of changing the structure of Australian banks' funding, and also reducing the cost of their funding as well.
Thank you for that. And there's another question, and that is, with regard to the loan deferral, how do we ensure that those proportion of population which have been, if you like, more negatively affected as a result of COVID-19, they will be in a position to come back to the workforce, have more sustainable jobs, and contribute at the same time, if you like, assist to a stronger and healthier economy as well as banking system? What are the measures that it's on the way, if you like?
Yeah. So the loan deferral, loan repayment deferrals have been a really important way of how banking systems globally have dealt with this pandemic. In effect, what we had was part of economic activity had to be curtailed in order to achieve acceptable health outcomes here and elsewhere. And so that meant that there were some businesses that had a very significant reduction in their income and households as well, and so couldn't make their loan repayments for a period of time. So the alternative is banks could have forced those people to try to make their repayments. They wouldn't have been able to, they would have defaulted, and then you would have had large asset sales, fire sales of assets, a lot of households and businesses with impaired balance sheets, and that would have been a significant problem. So loan repayment deferrals have been a really important way of how we've dealt with this. But what we want to make sure is that those deferrals are not used to hide problem loans. And so that's why it's important that APRA has a cutoff date for when the more favourable regulatory treatment on capital comes to an end, and so on 31st of March. And then banks will have to recognise they can still provide various forms of hardship assistance to borrowers, but they need to do that in a way that they're recognizing the potential impact on and taking into account the capital costs. So I think the main mechanisms to do that are switching from a more favorable capital treatment to a more sustainable long run position where banks do have to recognize any losses.
Wonderful, thank you so much. I think you have covered a number of grounds, and I think it's wonderful to see that people show interest, but also I think it's wonderful to see towards the end of this year, we are having one of the last, if you like, statements from one of the officials of Reserve Bank, which is reassuring us, and I think building confidence in the minds of people, as well as those who are the, if you like, decision makers, households, investors, and others is very important. And I'm sure they all benefited from this reassuring, but also very cautious approach that we all should take as we move towards 2021. Thank you so much for this presentation and also the answering all these great questions. Thank you again, Jonathan.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure to join you.